7. Impeding Justice. Monday, June 12th, was a day of ritual, which masked the president's agita. Trump convened his first full cabinet meeting, a now infamous session in which U.S. government officials took turns pledging fealty to their master. On behalf of the entire senior staff around you, Mr. President, we thank you for the opportunity and the blessing that you've given us to serve your agenda and the American people, Reince Priebus crowed. But no one was loyal to anyone in the orbit of Donald Trump. The groveling of Priebus and others did little to distract Trump from his aspiration to end the special counsel investigation. Priebus and Steve Bannon met that same Monday with Christopher Ruddy, telling him the president had seriously been considering abruptly firing Robert Mueller. That evening, Ruddy said in an appearance on the PBS NewsHour that Trump was weighing whether to terminate the special counsel, a revelation that transfixed Washington. Trump was motivated by his conviction, fueled partially by the analysis of his lawyers, that Mueller had conflicts of interest. Mueller was rapidly building his team, hiring experienced litigators from top firms and hard-charging federal prosecutors. By mid-June, he had hired 13 lawyers. The team included Aaron Zebley, Mueller's former FBI chief of staff, James Quarles, a former Watergate assistant special prosecutor, Jeannie Rhee, a former prosecutor and partner with Mueller at WilmerHale, Michael Dreeben, a deputy solicitor general known as one of the country's foremost legal thinkers, and Andrew Weissman, a famed Enron prosecutor and a former chief of the Justice Department's criminal fraud section. Many additional lawyers were itching to be a part of this historic investigation, and Mueller was preparing to hire some of them. Trump's lawyers closely studied the backgrounds of Mueller's hires and saw a pattern. Though Mueller was registered as a Republican and appointed FBI director by Bush, many of the lawyers joining his team were Democrats, and some had given money to Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign. Trump's lawyers also thought there was a decent legal argument that Mueller was conflicted out of being special counsel because he had met with Trump the day before his appointment for what the president claimed was a job interview. Mueller could have learned Trump's thinking about the probe and whether Trump implied he required loyalty in his next FBI director. Either way, he could be a witness who had an improper window into the mind of the investigation's key subject. Mark Kasowitz and Mike Bowe shared this information with Trump during a meeting with his legal team, and he was elated. A 1-2 punch, he thought. The special counsel's team was politically biased, and Mueller himself could be disqualified from leading the probe. The president became particularly enamored with the idea that Mueller was conflicted because the two men had what he called a business dispute. Mueller once belonged to Trump National Golf Club in Northern Virginia and sought to recoup some of his membership fees when he moved. Trump's lawyers tried to get their client to realize this was not a strong case of a conflict of interest, but the president could not be persuaded. He wouldn't stop mentioning the business dispute as a fatal flaw in Mueller's appointment. Testifying June 13th before a Senate Appropriations Subcommittee, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who officially oversaw the special counsel probe, tried to assuage fears building in Washington that Trump intended to terminate Mueller. I'm not going to follow any orders unless I believe those are lawful and appropriate orders, Rosenstein said. He added, Special Counsel Mueller may be fired only for good cause. Rosenstein's remarks were intended to affirm the Justice Department would uphold the rule of law, irrespective of any impulsive decree by the president. But they did not persuade Trump to drop the issue. About 7 p.m. the next day, June 14th, The Washington Post reported that Mueller had expanded his Russia probe to include an examination of whether Trump had attempted to obstruct justice. Trump himself was now under investigation, which was precisely what he had spent the spring pressuring his FBI director and intelligence agency heads to publicly deny. The administration was stuck in an unremitting season of investigations, and the president was enraged. Around this time, he called Chris Christie. "Should I fire Mueller?" Trump asked the New Jersey governor. "Mr. President, if you fire Mueller, you're going to be impeached," Christie replied. "Sure as day follows night, you will be impeached." "Do you really believe that?" Trump asked. "I absolutely believe that," Christie said, arguing that even Republicans in Congress could vote to impeach him for terminating the special counsel. "If there's anybody who's encouraging you to fire Mueller and somehow that will end your problems, it will only compound your problems. Don't do it." Around 10 p.m. on June 14th, Trump called Don McGahn on his cell phone. He was steaming hot and wanted to find out if the investigation really was trained on him. And if so, how could this have happened? He told the White House counsel to talk with Rosenstein and push the deputy attorney general. He had to remove Mueller because of what the president believed were conflicts of interest. "You got to do this," Trump told McGahn. "You got to call Rod." McGahn was more than a little annoyed by Trump's obsession with Mueller's conflicts, which he considered silly and of little merit. He again told the president that the conflicts case was not very strong and that his personal lawyers should be raising the issue, not the White House counsel. But on a night when every cable news channel was fixated on the news that Trump was a subject of a criminal investigation, the president was not thinking rationally and would not take no for an answer. "I'll see what I can do," McGahn said, giving his boss a noncommittal answer to get him off the phone. McGahn hung up, shaking his head at the president's unreasonable demands. The next day, June 15th, should have been a moment of celebration for both Trump and McGahn. The Supreme Court Associate Justice Neil Gorsuch's investiture ceremony was at 2 p.m. that Thursday. Installing a conservative on the court was the first major achievement of Trump's presidency, a key campaign promise fulfilled, and Gorsuch's smooth nomination had largely been orchestrated by McGahn. But Trump rose early and began venting his anger at the obstruction probe on Twitter. For weeks, his lawyers and aides had tried to wean Trump off Twitter, fearful that his comments could create greater legal exposure for him. Kasowitz would plead with Trump, "Enough of the tweeting. You've got to stop talking about the case. Enough. Just let us do our jobs." But they eventually resigned themselves to merely managing his missives. "They made up a phony collusion with the Russians story, found zero proof, so now they go for obstruction of justice on the phony story. Nice," Trump tweeted. "You are witnessing the single greatest witch hunt in American political history, led by some very bad and conflicted people," he wrote in a second tweet. McGahn later told associates that he contemplated skipping the ceremony altogether because the testy talk with Trump over the phone the night before had so deflated him. But he attended, figuring the investiture was history and he would be mad at himself if he didn't witness it. The leaders of all three branches of government came together for the solemn ceremony and congratulated McGahn as the proud father. That weekend, Trump made his first visit to Camp David, the famed presidential retreat in the Maryland mountains. He seemed to be in good spirits as he boarded Marine One for the 20-minute helicopter flight there. and McGahn assumed Trump had put his reckless Mueller plan behind him. But on the morning of Saturday, June 17th, Trump called McGahn on his cell phone again. It was Father's Day weekend, and McGahn had slept in and was at home getting ready for a full day of family events planned for his son's birthday. "Call Rod," Trump told McGahn. "Tell Rod that Mueller has conflicts and can't be the special counsel." McGahn put a hand to his forehead. This idea wasn't dead after all. "Mueller has to go," Trump continued. "Call me back when you do it." This was an inflection point. As McGahn would later tell confidants, it was Comey 2, the sequel. He did not want to participate in another obstructive episode. He had no intention of actually calling Rosenstein, out of fear Rosenstein would also consider it a directive and that it might trigger him to take some drastic and irreversible step. But McGahn also did not want to fight Trump on his idea. Instead, he just replied methodically, "Yeah, boss," and "Okay." He was worn down, so tired of Trump's bullshit. He just wanted to get off the phone and think through the choice he now faced. McGahn drove from his home in a gated community near Mount Vernon to the White House and began to collect his things. He felt he had to quit. He figured the next time Trump called to confirm that his orders were being carried out, he would tell him he was resigning. McGahn told his chief of staff, Annie Donaldson, he was submitting a letter of resignation, but didn't tell her the details of why. He was specifically trying to shield her from exposure to this obstruction of justice, so he told her only that Trump demanded he contact the Justice Department to do something McGahn did not want to do. McGahn later called Priebus. "I'm done," he told the chief of staff. "I've packed up my car. There's nothing in my office. I packed up all my things. I'm done." "What are you talking about?" Priebus asked. "Why are you done? What happened?" "I'm tired of the president asking me to do crazy shit," McGahn said, declining to elaborate further. "You're not resigning," Priebus told him. "You can't resign. You're going to relax for today, and we're going to talk tomorrow. But you're not resigning. You can't do that to the staff. You cannot instantly resign from your position at a time when we need you." McGahn then spoke with Bannon, who tried to talk him out of resigning by underscoring how valuable he was to the president by taking stands like the one he was taking now. "It's already Saturday night," Bannon told McGahn. "You can't do anything now." Trump did not call back that night, so the urgency McGahn had felt that afternoon passed as the night wore on. McGahn reluctantly agreed to stay on, but told Bannon things had to change. "We gotta get a real lawyer in here, because I can't keep being put in the middle of this shit," McGahn said. "This is all fucked up." Trump would later claim that he never asked McGahn to help him fire Mueller, which technically was true. He hadn't used the word fire. But it was clear to McGahn what Trump wanted him to do. On Friday, June 16th, as Trump was preoccupied with trying to remove Mueller, his lawyers had their first meeting with the special counsel. This was the meeting Trump had been pushing them to have since he had officially hired Kasowitz in May. In Mueller's temporary offices near Union Station, Kasowitz, Beau, and Dowd introduced themselves. Accompanying Mueller were Quarles and Zebley. The Trump team soon broached the elephant in the room, the news reports that Mueller was now investigating the president himself. "You know, Bob, I don't know if you are investigating the president," Dowd said. "Maybe you're doing a preliminary inquiry, but we have several views about why you can't have a president obstructing justice." Beau walked through the law, point by point, that gave the president broad constitutional powers to fire any appointee and take action on investigations. Mueller listened carefully. His stone-faced expression never changed. The lawyers said they had two more concerns about Comey's credibility as a witness and the conflicts they felt Mueller had in serving as special counsel. They asked if the prosecutors would like their legal arguments spelled out in memo form. Polite, but revealing nothing, Mueller said, "We're happy to take any presentation you have." Dowd said a lengthy investigation could hurt Trump. "We've got a president who's got to govern. We'll get you whatever you need. In exchange, I want a decision. We'll move it, you move it." Mueller replied, "You know me, John. I don't let any grass grow under my feet." Mueller had been in the job only a month at this point and made clear to Trump's lawyers that his team had a lot of work to do. The week before, Mueller's deputies had interviewed Andrew Goldstein, who would become a key investigator into whether the president obstructed justice. In the days just before and after their meeting with Trump's lawyers, Mueller's team held strategy sessions about getting a legal agreement with Cypriot authorities to obtain evidence they might be able to seize inside a storage locker belonging to Paul Manafort, Trump's former campaign chairman. While Trump's legal team presented a united front with Mueller, some were suspicious about a mysterious enemy slinging arrows their way, targeting those who had raised concerns about Jared Kushner. On June 19th, Corallo alerted his bosses, Kasowitz and Beau, that he had been contacted by the New York Times that day for comment on a story about tweets he sent in 2016 criticizing Trump's candidacy and disparaging Ivanka Trump and Kushner by suggesting their hiring raised doubts about Trump's commitment to draining the swamp. Corallo had actually flagged the tweets to Trump senior advisors before his hiring on the legal team and found it odd and unsettling they were being reported as news. The next day, June 20th, a client contacted a lawyer at the Kasowitz firm to alert him that a ProPublica reporter had been asking him about allegations that Kasowitz had been absent from the firm for lengthy periods in the recent past. ProPublica had received a humiliating trove of secrets, which had been known to only a tiny handful of firm insiders, including allegations that Kasowitz struggled with alcohol abuse. Kasowitz assumed someone inside his firm had betrayed him, but he did not know who. On June 21st, Kasowitz and Beau briefed Trump on several pressing topics, which others would learn included their review of possibly problematic campaign emails they might have to turn over to Congress, and highlights of their first meeting with Mueller on June 16th, a subject Trump was eager to hear about. The two lawyers told the president they had conveyed his message, that the probe created a cloud over the president and was unfair. They reported Dowd's request that this not drag on, and Mueller's assurances he would not let any grass grow under my feet. Not long after, the president said, "I gotta meet this guy Dowd." In mid-June, Kasowitz and Beau still believed they could recruit someone else as lead attorney, with Dowd playing a supporting role. But they didn't have one yet. Beau agreed to bring Dowd over one afternoon for a late lunch with the president. Beau liked and respected Dowd, but also never expected to put him in charge of representing the president. For his meeting with the president, Dowd entered the president's offices, seeming to be in awe. Inside were Trump, Beau, Corallo, and Jay Sekulow. The men exchanged some pleasantries and took seats in the dining room to enjoy steak, fries, and Diet Coke, one of Trump's frequent lunch menus. The president asked Dowd, "So, do you have a relationship with this guy, Mueller?" "He's a Marine like me. Dowd said. I can relate to him, Mr. President. I can talk to him. What do you think he's doing, John? Trump asked. Dowd told the president he felt this could be wrapped up quickly. I think I can talk to Bob Mueller and get this done in a matter of weeks, he said. Attendees remembered Dowd's comment differently. Some thought he told the president he could get it resolved in a matter of months. Dowd disputed giving a time frame. Beau was stunned and looked over at Corallo, then stared at Dowd. He told associates later, he was working the president. At first, Trump sounded skeptical. Oh, I don't know, Trump said. Are you sure? Yes, sir, Dowd said. That's great. That's just great, the president replied. Corallo sensed in Dowd that day a satisfaction that, hey, this is what I've worked for my whole life. It's like a crowning achievement. I'm in the Oval Office, and the president is my client now. That's a big deal. It went to John's head, and he decided to take over. Kasowitz and Beau tried to persuade Trump to stay calm and wait for Mueller to act, but that proved impossible. The self-proclaimed master counterpuncher used every platform he had to decry the investigation and cast himself as a victim of an unfair witch hunt. The president at first followed his lawyer's advice not to personally attack the special counsel, but pleaded daily with those on his legal team to blast Mueller as conflicted, dirty, and staffed by Democrats. Steaming mad over press coverage of the investigation, Trump was taping his weekly video address on an unrelated topic in the diplomatic reception room of the White House one day, when he sought help outside his cautious legal team. He gave an unusual directive to Cliff Sims, one of the press aides helping with the taping. I want you to go write the most scathing thing you've ever written about the Mueller investigation, about this witch hunt, and come back to me by the end of the day, and I'll record that video, Trump told Sims. Sims scurried back to his desk and quickly typed about 500 words. The rhetoric was bellicose and conspiratorial. This is a coup, the script read. It went far beyond the language Trump had used to date to describe the Russia investigation. Sims envisioned the president's remarks not only eviscerating Mueller, but also rallying his supporters to his defense. His conceit was that Mueller and his prosecutors were coming after not Trump, but rather the voters who put him in office by seeking to overturn the election results. We're in this together against these people who are trying to delegitimize our victory, the script read. Sims knew his coup script was over the top. He showed it to Hope Hicks, the West Wing's wisest interpreter of Trump's instincts and decrees. This is insane, Hicks said. What do you want me to do with this? Sims asked. Well, the president asked you to do something, she replied. Go show it to him. Sims found Trump behind the Resolute desk and handed him the script. I wrote this because you asked for it, Sims said. But this would be a disaster if you record this video. Trump read it and agreed. You're right, Trump said. We won't do it this time, but just hold on to it in case we ever want to use it. For once, Trump exhibited restraint. Fresh in his mind that afternoon was his lawyer's advice not to attack Mueller. Yet at least part of Trump believed Sims' script was right, that this had been an attempted coup. The Mueller probe was not Trump's only fixation during this period. He was also unnerved by the Russia investigations underway on Capitol Hill. The president felt somewhat protected by the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence because it was chaired by a Trump devotee, Republican Congressman Devin Nunes of California. But the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence was another story. That committee's chairman, Senator Richard Burr of North Carolina, was an establishment-minded Republican with no particular affinity for Trump. Burr rightfully saw his committee as nonpartisan and worked closely with the panel's top Democrat, Senator Mark Warner of Virginia. Burr and Warner together had spoken forcefully about Russia's interference in the election, which the intelligence community determined was directed by the Kremlin with the explicit aim of helping Trump prevail. Trump was deeply insecure about the intelligence community's conclusion about Russian interference. He hated for anyone to think that he did not defeat Hillary Clinton entirely on his own, that his victory was somehow illegitimate. Suddenly, the president had an idea. He could somehow convince Burr of his innocence by sending him a pile of printed-out news articles and fact sheets that he believed exculpated him. So, during one of his meetings with McGahn in the Oval Office, Trump told the White House counsel he wanted to write a letter to Burr, with the news clippings attached. McGahn knew it was a dangerous idea. He told Trump that sending this letter would be unwise. If Burr interpreted such a letter signed by the president as demeaning or even hostile, it could jeopardize not only the Russia investigation, but also the administration's overall agenda in the Senate, including confirmation of federal judges, a top priority for both Trump and McGahn. What's more, it's not as if Burr didn't have his own easy access to such facts. "We can't do this," McGahn told the president. Trump came up with a plan B. McGahn would sign the letter instead. "Send the letter," Trump said. "I can't send the letter, sir," McGahn said. "We have other priorities up there." At that moment, Chris Christie walked into the Oval for a visit. Trump asked the New Jersey governor whether he would send the letter. "If Don believes that it will upset your ability to get judges confirmed by the Senate, then the answer is no," Christie told Trump. "That's more important than whatever the fucking letter says." McGahn was visibly relieved. So often he had been the West Wing's lone voice of resistance. Finally, someone else backed him up in refusing the president's order. Their defiance irritated Trump. "You're both jokes," the president told McGahn and Christie. "Okay, leave. Bye." As they departed the Oval, McGahn said to Christie, "I wish you were around every day." "Why's that?" Christie asked. "Because then I wouldn't be the only dick in the building," McGahn deadpanned. On June 21st, the Wall Street Journal published a story by Eli Stokols and Michael Bender, reporting that the White House was riven by division between senior aides, and that the expanding Russia investigations had frustrated Trump and exacerbated the administration's struggle to recruit new talent. The piece reflected poorly on Bannon and Priebus. Bannon was furious and lit into Hicks, screaming like a deck seaman at the former fashion model. He confronted her in front of Trump, accusing Hicks of having leaked a negative story to the Journal. She explained that her interactions had been entirely proper. It was, after all, her job to talk to reporters. Bannon was effectively taking on the president's family. No senior White House staffer, other than Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner, had a longer or deeper relationship with the president than Hicks, whom he treated like a surrogate daughter. The next day, June 22nd, Bannon, Hicks, Priebus, and Sean Spicer met in the chief of staff's office. Hicks knew she had done nothing wrong interacting with the Journal and expected Priebus and Spicer to defend her, but they did not. "You've been running around here for months just working for Ivanka and Jared," Bannon said to Hicks. "Your client is the man in the Oval Office," he added. "You don't actually work for the president. You forgot how you got here." Sitting at the end of Priebus's long conference table and looking down at his phone, Bannon threatened Hicks. "That's it. I'm going to war. You have no idea who you're messing with. I will end you." "You're going to war?" Hicks replied. "What the fuck have you been doing for the last 3 months? You've been twiddling on your BlackBerry, leaking to everybody." Hicks was furious. "The fact that my integrity is being questioned in front of the three of you, I can't believe this," she told Bannon, Priebus, and Spicer. "I'm leaving. When you guys are ready to apologize to me, I'll come back. But I'm leaving." That would be the last time Hicks spoke with Bannon. In early June, George Conway finally withdrew himself from consideration to lead the Civil Division as Assistant Attorney General. The night of June 24th, he came face to face with the president he decided not to serve. Conway and his wife Kellyanne were among the guests attending the wedding of Secretary of the Treasury Steve Mnuchin and the Scottish actress Louise Linton. The opulent event was held at one of Washington's grandest venues, the Mellon Auditorium, a historic neoclassical building named after the former Treasury Secretary Andrew Mellon. Vice President Pence officiated, and everyone who was anyone in the administration attended, including President Trump and First Lady Melania Trump. After taking their vows, Mr. and Mrs. Mnuchin were whisked away for formal pictures while guests were ushered into the cocktail reception. As guests nibbled on hors d'oeuvres before the formal seated dinner, Kellyanne Conway spotted Trump talking to a small cluster of people nearby, and she suggested to her husband that they walk over to say hello. Trump greeted them with a big smile, but without engaging in any basic pleasantries. No, "Hey, good to see you," or "How are the kids?" Trump brusquely jumped into a stream of complaints and epithets about how badly Jeff Sessions had failed him as an attorney general. He described how terrible and crazy it was for Sessions to recuse himself from the Russia investigation. Somehow, Trump had convinced himself that George Conway retreated from the Justice Department job because he did not want to work for someone as terribly weak as Sessions. "Hey, you know, I heard from some people that the lawyers at DOJ felt he had to recuse," George Conway said. "No, no," Trump said. The president then pointed a finger at George Conway's chest. "You're a smart guy. Not going to work for that weak guy," Trump said, grinning. "Very smart." George Conway smiled uncomfortably. After a few more minutes of Sessions bashing by Trump, the Conways said their goodbyes, explaining that others wanted to talk to Trump and they had better make their way to their table for dinner. Ironically, Sessions was supposed to sit at the Conways' table, but never showed. The Conways stopped to get a drink, and as they stood alone together, George Conway chuckled about the president's one-track mind. The president was uncontrollably obsessed with the weak Sessions. George laughed harder and was eventually doubled over. The next morning, though, George Conway replayed in his mind the parody that was Donald J. Trump. In the light of day, he now saw the events of the previous night as deeply disturbing. He had been cackling like a kid about Trump's buffoonish behavior. He was laughing at him, not with him. And the object of his ridicule was the President of the United States.